This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, economist Max Wolf joins us to talk about several structures that provide for tax deductions for corporations.
Well, the scandal came out most recently with the Corrections Corporation of America, which is a private prison corporation, asking to have a tax status change because it owns real estate. They're renting out their spot to prisoners.
Last month in Dallas, Texas, four former presidents and many dignitaries were on hand for the opening of the George W. Bush Library.
There were people with white death masks across the highway from the library carrying signs saying, "It's a crime against the mind."
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Billboard companies, casinos, and private prisons are now designating themselves, like many other American corporations, as special trusts in order to avoid paying federal taxes. The Corrections Corporation of America, which owns and operates 44 private prisons and detention centers around the country, has quietly received permission by the Internal Revenue Service to change its status to that of a real estate investment trust, thus saving tens of millions of dollars on taxes. These special trust structures, however, are usually reserved by funds holding real estate. Handing over state-related tasks, such as running a private penal institution, to the private sector is obviously going to be at the expense of the prison inmates. We talk about this tax designation, referring to private prisons, and regular tax avoidance, more generally, with Max Wolf, a teacher of economics in the New School University graduate program in New York City, and also a writer and a personality on the media, including BBC, National Public Radio, and The Wall Street Journal. Max Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A couple of things caught our interest in the last week. One was related to the Corrections Corporation of America, which has apparently switched to a so-called REIT, or Real Estate Investment Trust structure. What does that mean? It looks like they're going to save millions of dollars in taxes a year, like $70 million.
Yeah, so a REIT is an increasingly popular these days as an investment choice by both some institutions and individuals because REITs by law have advantageous tax treatment. It's a legal structure of ownership, and it requires you to get the better tax structure to pay out 90% of your earnings in dividends. And so it's sort of a pass-through structure that allows the investors to get income. Lots of investors are out there chasing income because it's hard to come by. What do I mean? Well, the federal government will give you less than 1.5% if you loan the federal government of the United States money for 10 years, otherwise known as the 10-year treasury. And the ability to make money on safe or highly rated corporate bonds is really at a historically anomalous low. So what you have is institutions, not-for-profits, individuals looking to get an income on their wealth and finding it fairly difficult to find appealing levels of income on that wealth. This drives them into an area called the REIT. It's a version of a unit investment trust. That's the legal and tax treatment. And what it allows you to do is get income that's taxed along dividend or capital gains rates. The reason that's advantageous is because through a kind of cruel twist of fate in modern America, well, to be honest, through a lot of lobbying spending that was successful and well spent, I guess, the tax rates on dividends and capital gains are fairly advantageous. They're lower. You can end up paying less than, say, the people who work for a living and standard jobs and are compensated and then taxed on labor income. They tend to pay more. This was probably made most famous in a comment by Warren Buffett, who wrote a very famous letter and proposed a solution, by the way, to this problem, now called the Buffett Rule after Warren Buffett. It's not Jimmy Buffett in this case, but Warren, probably more famous on the money side and a little bit more affluent than Jimmy Buffett as well. But his argument was, why do I pay a lower tax rate on my billions than my secretary pays, who works in this office? office? It's actually a pretty reasonable question on a social justice level. However, the answer is because your secretary makes labor income, like about 87% of the American public, and you don't, you make more investment income on things like dividends and capital gains. Over the years of lobbying and trying to induce and encourage various forms of investment, the real estate class of investments enjoys any number of special abilities to generate income and pay less taxes. One of them is ensconced in the law as a real estate investment trust, or REIT, R-E-I-T. It's just another acronym, right? And what this says is if you are making your money on capital gains on property or on rents on property, on licensing property, on renting out property, that and you're paying out the vehicle, you know, corporate chartered vehicle, pays out 90% or more of its earnings, it can get special tax treatment, and investors in it can enjoy a tax rate lower than, or as we like to say, preferable to, what normal working stiffs get for their blood, sweat, and tears, their effort, or their physical, mental labor across the period of a day, a week, a month, a year.
So the Corrections Corporation of America, which has been cited for having prisoners die in the 44 prisons they run, which is not giving adequate food and medical care to prisons since they took over from the public. Now they run these prisons privately. Now what do they do with the prisons that they now run? What do they do with respect to declaring themselves a real estate investment trust?
Right, so the Corrections Corporation of America is out to prove to the world that you can get tax advantage treatment even if you are doing God's work. And in this case, God's work is the privatization of incarceration of men and women and sometimes immigrants and children in the United States. And what they've decided, which makes sense, it's a smart move on a tax basis. Also, it's a smart move to attract investors. Clearly, when you're a company like Corrections Corporation of America, there will be certain folks, both institutional and individual, who find something about your operations, all scandals and allegations aside, distasteful. And so you'll have a reduced pool of potential investors. How do you increase the pool? You make the investment more appealing. How do you make the investment more appealing? You make it tax advantaged. How do you do that? In this case, you say, look, we're like a hotel, and there are hotels for REIT. They're REIT hotel, you know, hotel properties. Sure. Or an apartment
this
building.
This one you can check in, but you can't check out.
Right. So clearly the access to departure is different in this particular facility than you would at least hope for from your condo or rental unit or your hotel or, you know, corporate long stay apartment. However, if they are a unit investment trust and they do get their income from rents of a variety or a type, from the property of a type, even if it's a prison, then they can get tax advantage treatment and they can offer a little more to investors to possibly push back on some reticence in some corners related to their core operation, which has probably had more than its fair share of misadventures and may be distasteful to some investors.
Well, so they're essentially saying the money they get from the government to house and look over inmates is rental income. Would some find that distasteful to say they're profiting off inmates?
Yeah, no doubt there would be a lot of people who find this investment problematic or distasteful. I could see the progressive asset management community, some endowments and charitable funds might be a bit nervous, especially to make this a core holding. There could be pushback from various stakeholders in making a positive incremental profit on incarcerations. But that would only make it more important for them to offer tax advantage. And the other argument they could make, which probably does make a certain logical sense, is that they are basically providing a form of housing, even if it's incarcerative, and supervision to people at the behest of state, local, and federal authorities who have adjudicated cases and sentenced these people to a particular real estate stay of a variant duration.
And I understand that cell phone tower companies or companies that operate cell phone towers are saying that the towers themselves may constitute real estate.
Yeah, well, the towers, if they own the towers and rent them out to the phone carriers, then it's real estate. It's not that much different than owning an apartment building and renting it out. Instead, you own a cellular relay or signal booster tower, and you say, okay, I own these towers, and I'm renting them out to T-Mobile or AT&T or Verizon or, you know, Sprint, whichever the carriers might be, and I want the tax advantage treatment. I want to be able to raise income and raise investment from folks who are looking for tax advantaged income. Once you have a popular with investors category, that can also receive advantageous tax treatment, then teams of lawyers will go out and get to work with economists and accountants and figure out how to shove everything they possibly can into that bucket. And then the game begins, right? It's always cat and mouse here. So the regulators are usually a bit behind in terms of the staffing and the acumen of their various attorneys. And you do the best you can. Sometimes in the investment community, we have a little nickname for this. It's very telling, if not maybe the best from a public relations standpoint. We call it Reg Arb, regulation arbitrage. So if you can move ahead of the regulator, then you can arbitrage the holes, the backward, the time lags that the regulator has to do things that you may suspect one day will come to an end. But if that day isn't today, then today is a good day, you know, and the sun is shining. And so, you know, you make your hay.
Now, looking at a potential problem, however, I understand there are over 1,000 real estate investment trusts currently. And one commentator has said that it's not out of the realm of possibility to imagine that soon railroads, highways, landfills, vineyards, farmland, and other so-called immovable structures could be considered rights. What does that mean in terms of loss of tax revenue for the rest of us and for communities?
Sure. Well, anytime you can take a series of assets and reduce the tax burden on those assets, it means that the various federal, state, and local authorities dependent on or needing those tax revenues will go without. And if the past is prologue, or if it tells us the future, then it's our best basis for that, the game of forecasting, then we'll know and we can guess the following. We'll see more regressive taxes and take the form of more lottery tickets sold, more casinos downtown, more scratch tickets, and we'll see them hitting the general public for more money and or reducing services, usually both. So for a New York City listener, this is the $2.50 subway ride that used to be $2.25 back when they used to say do things like clean the platform and have more cars on the train and run more trains. And it's the long line outside of every bodega in New York City to buy scratch tickets, which is a regressive tax, or it's the bold vision of Mayor Bloomberg to try to charge $325 for a pack of cigarettes so he can get, you know, low-income people in the Bronx to pay cigarette taxes so that he doesn't have to pay the higher toll on, say, his real estate holdings there in the 70s on the East Side, in that barrio that he calls home.
Does this have any impact on more traditional kinds of trusts if this becomes a burgeoning field?
Sure. Well, part of what happens if a group of folks innovate themselves into a tax-protected structure is that the folks who didn't get into the tax-protected structure get hurt because the investors look at them and say, look, I can give you the money and you'll give me 4%, but I'll pay higher taxes, or I can give the money to the folks over at CCA or whomsoever, and I'll get the 4%, but I'll get to keep more of it, right? So it hurts the people who don't take the tax advantaged move, and it pulls investment from the higher tax paying groups into the lower tax paying groups, which also has ramifications for all kinds of public funding and public solvency issues. I think you're sort of getting at, in a roundabout way, another issue, which is part of what we're seeing here is privatization of public assets, things that were done by federal, state, and local governments. Once that's done, you already kind of get this weird windfall often of wealth to the private company, assuming that the terms of the privatization are often open to some serious question and doubt in terms of whether the public gets every dime it should. But then they're also going to go back, take the public property, and then try to pay less taxes on it once it's privatized. And part of what you're seeing there is that story with the REITs, especially in regard to things like the prison-related REITs.
Max, let's look at the larger picture here. Not just that certain corporations are avoiding taxes or lowering their taxes by declaring themselves a real estate investment trust. But let's talk about how these large corporations are avoiding taxes more generally, their offshore operations, what they do to put an even greater burden on the rest of us who go to work every day for a living.
Sure. Well, we've seen a movement, really kind of a long-term secular movement in the United States since the 1970s. So it's about 40 years in the making now. And we've seen that move by large American corporations to do a whole host of things, one of which is to become global, right? I think the best quote on this actually comes from one of the corporate titans, a particularly smart and agile fellow named Sam Palmisano, who used to be at the head of the IBM Corporation, which probably almost everyone's heard of or have dealt with their products directly and indirectly. And he made a various statement, which I think was very accurate, very bold. And he said, IBM is not an American company. It's a global company. It's a multinational enterprise. guys. We happen to have historically had an initial home in the United States. The end. We are a multinational enterprise. We'll look for homes, we'll look for tax advantages, and we'll look for markets wherever the opportunity is, whether that's in Timbuktu or Flint, Michigan. Right. And we'll leave where the opportunity isn't and we'll go where the opportunity is. The other thing that's kind of developed here is that the United States of America has a fairly high effect, you know, corporate tax rate, legal, not effective. So we have a 35% corporate tax rate. Once you're a multinational enterprise, you will try to pay taxes in whatever jurisdiction has the lowest rate. That's not the United States. An entire field, my field, in fact, to some extent, developed around this called transfer pricing, where inside multinational companies, you actually invoice out of high tax jurisdictions into low tax jurisdictions. So if the American company is going to have $100 million in profit and then have to pay $35 million in taxes, which they might, why not have the Irish subsidiary sell them something for $80 million? Then the profit vanishes from the US jurisdiction and pops up in Ireland. Why is that interesting? Then the 35% effective tax rate, the US rate, becomes the 11% effective tax rate in Ireland. Presto changeo, a $35 million tax bill becomes an $11 million tax bill. Last time I checked, that's a $24 million savings. That will pay you for a lot of people, a lot of men and women who do the job of moving the money from the high tax location to the low tax location. And that is actually just one of a quiver full of arrows that are now available. Maybe the easiest way to tell this picture is at one point in the 50s and 60s, corporations paid about 30% of the income to the federal government and their taxes. As we sit and chat with each other today in New York City, they're paying about 8% of the taxes. And as we all know, the largest corporations in the United States have done quite well. So they're not paying less taxes as a percentage of the total taxation because they're doing poorly. They're not. They're paying because they're doing well. And part of what they've done with the money, wisely, is figure out ways to pay less taxes.
Can you just go back to the beginning of that Ireland example? You said that if Ireland gives...
The Irish have a low corporate tax rate. It's part of the reason that you see so much corporate activity
right there.
I mean, so maybe the most recent case in the news, there's actually a tax avoidance strategy called the Dutch Double Irish, it's sort of famous. It's done by many of the leading tech companies, maybe most aggressively pursued by Apple Computer Corporation. So the Apple Computer Corporation had an interesting week. Right? Apple is literally floating in or drowning, some would even say, in cash. So Apple's holding more than $130 billion in cash. Yet this week, for the first time in 20 plus years, they went to the debt market and they borrowed money. They have no debt because they don't need to, because they're enormously profitable and they have an enormous amount of cash. So you might ask yourself, as some did, why is a company with trying to figure out what to do with $140 billion in cash borrowing money? Well, because if their money, the 140, much of it, not all, but much of the money is held offshore because they don't want to pay the U.S. taxes. If they bring it back and do something with the money, they suddenly have to pay the taxes. So the money becomes 35% less money notionally. So they'd rather borrow money here than pay taxes here. And so they do. It's also tax advantageous to borrow. So they will get tax advantages by borrowing here and avoid having to pay tax freight here by keeping their money, in this case, offshore, not all but much in Ireland, which has been attractive for companies of all types, not to single out Apple. Lots of companies do it because of the very low corporate tax rate in Ireland.
And how many years has this been going on?
This particular strategy?
Yeah.
It's had various forms. At one point, it was illegal. It is not illegal anymore. But I think it's been major for 12, 15 years. It's not like some dirty little secret. It's well known. Hundreds of articles have been written about it. It's fairly well known. It's in the press, et cetera. I mean, it's not on Good Morning America every day, but it's not exactly hidden.
Max, you said that there are a number of arrows in the quiver on how to get around paying fair and reasonable amount of tax. We talked about a couple of them so far. But give our audience another example or two about how these big corporations avoid paying their fair share.
Well, the bad news is I'm not an accountant, so I don't know most of them. And the really bad news is I know a lot of them. So you can only imagine how many there actually are. And again, So I don't want to overstate my expertise. There are plenty of folks out there who could give you the 360-degree picture, and I'd probably give you 90 degrees at best. But there are all kinds of ways of doing what's called transfer pricing, which we mentioned earlier, moving profits from high-tax jurisdictions to low-tax jurisdictions. There are various insurance schemes. There are ways to pay your employees with equities, that with stock, that allow you to lower your tax burden, to even take write-offs. There are things you can do with debt. There's your charitable giving games. I mean, this really is hundreds of thousands of people make a good living helping large corporations pay less taxes. And I think the public has become increasingly aware of this. We know, you know, just a basic back of the envelope, that you're now talking hundreds of billions of dollars that the federal government did not collect. So it's a lot of money. And it's a kind of money that you'd normally expect folks to be looking at kind of intently right now, because we're about to have austerity programs because the government doesn't have money, right? And so think about this earlier this year, really under the push of the Obama administration, but with little fight from various other parties and the Republicans in the House and Senate, we saw the increase in the payroll tax. And the increase in the payroll tax is hitting the average working American in the pocket, right? And there is a bit of a big political question, again, maybe more for someone besides myself, maybe more for somebody who's got their finger on the pulse of American politics, why we're willing to look to struggling working people for a few extra bucks a day, but have had a hard time collecting the legally stipulated tax burden from some of our most successful enterprises.
Given that many examples you've given are legal, is there a trend at all in terms of regulation that would make some of them illegal again?
Sure, there's constantly bills suggested and agitations. There's a bit of a game here. So the federal government does try to close down the more aggressive or more embarrassing versions of these as they get too much press, too much discussion, or if they occasion heavy public outrage. There's another little piece, though, that's economics that people tend to miss, which is if I'm a large corporation, the taxes I didn't have to pay you for the last 4 years, I'm actually using to buy legislation to pay less tax next year. So these things tend to have cumulative effects, whether they're getting worse or getting better, that the money I didn't have to spend on my taxes, I can use for things like public relations campaigns, lobbyists, if we want to be a little bit skeptical about our political system, perhaps buying some special access to some of the men and women in our various elected office. So in other words, I will use the tax money I didn't pay last year to pay less taxes next year. And part of the problem, I think, that we find ourselves in 2013 is that people are using the taxes they didn't pay for the last 40 years to not have to pay as much taxes for the next 40 years. And these folks tend to be, you know, smart and savvy and hardworking and dedicated and well-funded, and they have talented employees.
Max, you mentioned that your area of expertise does include this Irish double Dutch.
I mean, I'm familiar with it.
What else do you sort of focus on?
So we look at that in part because where I actually work, what we actually do is pay close attention to leading tech companies. Leading tech companies across the board tend to be fairly aggressive practitioners here because a lot of them do have their European operations in or revenues running through Ireland. So it's quite common with, you know, particular Apple, but Google, Microsoft, Oracle, your sort of larger tech companies. But in no way, shape, or form are they alone, by the way. This isn't some kind of, I don't want to pathologize any particular company. Look, it is the fiduciary burden of the company to maximize the return to the shareholders. And part of the way you do that is get the lowest effective tax rate.
Is this in part why Ireland is actually recovering financially?
Well, partly Ireland has the kind of blessing as well as the curse of an easy comparison. Things went pretty terribly wrong in Ireland for several years starting in 08, 09. So to some extent, they have had a bit of a recovery. There is investment coming back. This is a small piece of it. So Ireland is a very investor-friendly place to go. So fairly light regulatory burden, very friendly government and regulators, fairly diligent, hardworking Eurozone employees who are not the most expensive employees in the Eurozone, and a very accommodative tax structure.
Well, what would you say about the United States? Things have been in the doldrums here since 2008. How do you see it proceeding here?
So the economy has been in the doldrums. It's been a pretty good period for Fortune 500 corporations, right? So it depends on, you know, who we're talking about, whether it's sort of doldrums or pinnacle or top of the mountain. So American corporations, large American corporations, obviously with some notable exceptions, have done incredibly well, right? So one thing to think about is the percentage of the total income in the United States, that's corporate profits, is bouncing around at the highest level ever recorded since we started keeping numbers in the 1930s. So that's a 70, 80 year period, and we're at the top of it. Partly that's because incomes aren't so good. Wages haven't gone up in 5 years. We have a high unemployment rate. But it's also because the Fortune 500 corporate fortunes have been quite strong. So the corporations have done fairly well. The overall economy hasn't done terribly well. The United States is a sort of tricky story. So we have a very high de jure tax rate here under the law, but we have a pretty low what's called effective tax rate. So technically, large U.S. corporations and all U.S. corporations pay approximately a 35% corporate tax rate, which is high by global standards. However, the effective tax rate the largest U.S. corporations pay is more like 16 or 17%. So they're literally paying a little less than or around half of that legal rate through all kinds of various deductions and special allowances and schemes, all of which in general are legal, but they're effectively able to at least half their tax bill.
And for your average American, how much taxes do working people pay in terms of the percentage of their income?
Yeah, so the Americans actually pay less of their income in taxes than a lot of other people around the world and in a lot of points in American history. However, the middle, upper middle class American is paying virtually the entire tax bill. Very, very affluent Americans are able to offload significant portions of their tax liability, and large corporations are. So the portion of the tax bill being paid by the middle and upper middle class is historically high, even though the actual rates aren't historically unusual by international or historical standards. Probably the flip side of it is, what are these folks getting for what they pay? What they're getting is probably less services on the way to becoming even less services, in part because other folks aren't paying their fair share. So they may be paying a little less than they were historically, but they're probably getting a lot less than they were historically, because even if they're paying, others aren't. Right? And it becomes a cultural issue on some point. It's not even really economics. When it becomes acceptable, desirable, business as usual, to use wealth and influence to cut your tax burden, you have a situation where there's going to be less tax collection. And the final way to understand this is the biggest corporations and the wealthiest people have taken home a constantly rising portion of this country's wealth. So the problem we have now is if the very wealthy and the big corporations don't pay as much taxes, and they don't, that's much worse in terms of the macroeconomic impact, because those folks, the highest income earners, the biggest companies, they're taking home a historically unusual fraction of the total wealth. So if you upward redistribute money, which we did, and then you undertax the apex, the commanding heights of the economy, then you have a real major tax shortfall, because you're taxing less the institutions, big companies, and the individuals, very wealthy individuals, who are taking home most of the money. So if you don't get them, then you're going to have a much more substantive numerical shortfall in your tax collection. And if you look at the last 5 years, that's a lot of the story of the ballooning deficits.
And if we continue to privatize more services, this problem is going to worsen.
We would assume, unless the privatization somehow operates differently than it has the last 20 years, which would be a strange assumption to make, yes, then we would assume that you're just taking things, you know, public assets, turning them into private assets, and you're saying, okay, we believe that the profit motive is the best way to house people sentenced to jail time, or run a park, or run a highway, or a bridge, or a parking authority, or whatever it is. And that would tend, all things being equal, to grow inequality for a lot of reasons, partly because the unionized public sector jobs, which tend to have decent wages and good benefits, would be more likely to be replaced by less benefit generous, less well-paid jobs, and more of the money would pass through to profit, which will go to the already more affluent institutions and individuals.
What do the rich people and corporations do with all these profits? Where do they go?
Well, I mean, there's endless things you can spend your money on, whether you're a large corporation or an affluent individual. Part of where they've historically gone, which is probably meaningful to our story, is they've gone to campaigns. And they've gone to campaigns and to lobbyists to be able to take home more of your money if you're a high income earner. So they've gotten themselves into this, the PAC business and the super PAC business and the lobby business and the campaign donation business in all varieties. They've driven a giant consolidation in lots of industrial areas. Maybe one of the more interesting areas, they've driven a massive media consolidation, where big profitable companies buy up rivals and smaller companies with those profits and become even larger and even more powerful. And then with being larger and being more powerful, they may be more able to pay lower taxes and become larger and more powerful. And There are vicious and virtuous cycles here. And if we've been in a sort of vicious cycle from government tax collection for about 40 years, then you can imagine how much momentum the ball rolling down the hill can pick up over a few decades.
Max, this has been utterly fascinating as usual. Thank you so much for enlightening us about the REIT, or real estate investment trust structure, and everything else financial.
Max, can you loan me $5 till Friday?
Sure, what's the interest rate?
Max, well, thanks so much for being on Law & Disorder.
It was my pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last month in Dallas, Texas, four living presidents and many dignitaries were on hand for the official opening of the Bush Library. Protesting the event, and relegated to the so-called free speech zone across the street, were members of the white mass group March of the Dead. While George W. Bush was being recognized, a procession of the We Will Not Be Silent marchers carried the names of many who lost their lives in Afghanistan, Iraq, Bagram, Abu Ghraib, and Guantanamo prisons. The marchers also carried the names of civilians, U.S. military, and detainees tortured to death because of war crimes committed by the Bush administration. We welcome back Lori Arbiter, who organized the action at the Bush Library. Lori is an artist and activist and creator of the We Will Not Be Silent Collective. Lori, welcome back to Law & Disorder.
Thank you for having me back.
Lori, you just came back from Texas.
Yes. Congratulations on surviving.
You were down there for the opening of the George W. Bush Library. Give us an idea of what it was like to be down there, the library. I mean, the guy was reading a story about my pet goat last time I saw him with a book. Now he's opening up a library. What was it like at the opening?
Well, one thing, we brought a sign. We brought many signs down because we have a new collection of signs. And we made some just for this. And the one we designed was "The Bush Library, A Crime Against the Mind." And we carried that around actually a couple of days even leading up to the opening. And I think a lot of people agree and have responded well to that sign. And hearing that the library was opening, this was several years ago, I felt compelled that we had to be there. And so did others. Actually, the organizing force behind this were people in Dallas. So they did organize something called the People's Response. And we followed their lead. They invited us back. And we were asked to do something that we did in 2006 in Washington, the March of the Dead. So the March of the Dead returned to the opening of the Bush Library.
Paint a picture for us of what it looked like, the March of the Dead.
In 2006, we conceived the March of the Dead, and we actually put a call out to join us in Washington, D.C., and we marched out of Arlington Cemetery with 100 and more people behind us, each wearing a death mask, a white death mask that we created. And then we also hand wrote signs with the names of military that had lost their lives in both Afghanistan and Iraq and civilians in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And here we also added the names of those tortured in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo and in Bagram. So we searched names of people that lost their lives in those three prisons under the Bush regime.
And how was the street scenario in terms of where you were allowed to march? Were you confined to a specific area?
Oh, yes. They call it a free speech zone now, which is really Orwellian, because we experience it as a no speech zone. And it's there where they try to render us invisible. We were across a highway. That's how absurd it's getting. We weren't across even the street. We were across a highway, several lane highways, and police all around. But they had us, you know, at bay there. And they even tried to take that zone away. And the people in Dallas are mounting a civil suit against the, and they did get an injunction right before to allow us to even be in a space that they had already been permitted to be in. But they even tried to take that away.
And what was their argument? Are they saying, again, public safety, the number of presidents that were on hand?
They do. They actually do talk about public safety. There's some old ordinance in the city that they used. I don't know from exactly what year, but they said that you cannot hold a sign in 75 feet from the side of a highway. They evoked that to try to keep us from having signs in that space, even though we were very far from anyone to see.
You know, the irony, Laurie and Heidi, is that after the planes hit the buildings on 9/11, and everybody was asking why, Bush said they did it because they hate us for our freedoms. And then he said, yeah, go shopping. We know what it was like when you were down there. Let's talk about why you went down there. Let's talk about what the United States did to Iraq. Iraq, I mean, after 9/11, they used it as an excuse to attack and decimate Iraq. So let's talk about why you went down there.
Well, as I said before, the March of the Dead was first conceived in 2006. And we held those names because these were people that we felt, both soldiers and civilians in those countries, that lost their lives for no good reason. And especially, I think there's a lot of controversy around Iraq. I mean, not controversy, a lot of people who know now the truth, that we should never have gone in there.
There were no weapons
of mass destruction. There was no imminent threat from that country to us. And they lied to the American people. And actually, while we were down there, Larry Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's, worked
and
under his...
Colin Powell?
Colin Powell was the Secretary of State under the Bush.
And this is...
And the man that took a small vial of talcum powder, probably, and held it up on the floor of the UN to tell us that Saddam Hussein had... This was used as a symbol of the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the absurdity that brought us to a place of invading a country. I don't call it a war. I call it an illegal invasion. and hundreds of thousands, and in some cases, the Lancet in England said over a million people had lost their lives. And we left the country. We're supposed to be bringing democracy there. It's, you know, it's in a state of complete and utter destruction. It already was in a state of destruction from all our sanctions under Clinton. But we went further and invaded. And Larry Wilkerson, to get back to what I was saying, he stood up in the Dallas University and he said, we went in there because of oil. He did not in any way qualify. He said, now we went in there because of oil. And he is speaking out. He is basically, now he's out of that administration. He left. He understands the ramifications of what he was attached to and what he did. And he now, I think, his conscience has caught up with him and he is speaking out. We have a war criminal that now was honored by the four other living presidents. I can understand his father showing up, but Barack Obama, Clinton, and Carter honoring him, caught in pictures that the media showed, laughing and joking around. This man he gave orders to torture people and admitted it with his vice president on a book tour. I mean, his vice president went on a book tour. George W. Bush has since been interviewed many, many times. He has admitted that they did give orders to waterboard. And what's interesting is then you follow to the next administration and you have Eric Holder, he's our attorney general, the head of the Justice Department, saying under oath, waterboarding is torture. And then you look and you look it up. Anyone can. Torture is illegal under the UN conventions and under our laws. How do you follow with having men admit publicly that they did waterboard, waterboard is torture, and torture is a crime, and they are the law is not coming to prosecute them? That's a crime against our minds too and our intelligence.
Totally undercuts the rule of law.
I understand, Laurie, that after the Bush Library inauguration, you went outside the medical facility where Lynn Stewart is. And what was that like?
Well, I also look at Lynn Stewart as another casualty of Bush's war on terror. Lynn is in the facility right now. We went there with a mission to have a presence outside of the facility. We actually called Ralph Pointer, her husband, before we left to let him know and ask if that would be okay for us to make that presence
Let's just remind our listeners that Lynn Stewart is the now disbarred attorney serving 10 years in prison for her representation of a Sheikh Abdul Rahman who was accused of conspiring to commit terrorism in the United States. She defended him. She issued a press release related to his political positions. And for that issuance of a press release, she was sentenced to 28 months in prison. The government and the federal system can appeal a criminal sentence, and they did. The judge's higher-ups, including Bush's cousin, Judge Walker, raised the sentence to 10 years. And she had a reoccurrence of cancer while in prison. She has stage 4 metastasized cancer that has spread from her lungs, and she's in a federal prison in Texas where you went to see her and stood outside the prison. So continue with your description of what it was like out there.
Well, we pulled up right to the gates of the prison, and we got out, and we actually had about 15 of us came together, two of us from New York carrying signs that said, Lynn Stewart, release Lynn Stewart, love, compassion, the right to justice, the right to walk free. There were several. We held those up. Oh, also, our democracy silences dissent. So we got out of the cars and we just stood in front there and began taking photographs so we could have a document that we were there. And we waited, you know, keeping watch to see if anybody would come to stop us. And I think we flew in on the wings of justice there because nobody came. And so we took more and more pictures and video, which we're compiling now, and we're going to send out with an appeal to sign a petition to ask for her compassionate release. So we then got in the cars and drove up further because we wanted to see beyond along the road, how if we could see more of the prison. And of course, as you got up the road, you did see more of the prison and razor wire. And then suddenly, there they were on top of the building, looking out at us. There were two officials, and then suddenly more officials came with walkie-talkies. But they were still inside of the prison walls. So we made a judgment to move on because we wanted to save the photos we had and bring them home so we could make an appeal to lots and lots more people.
It's actually remarkable that you were able to be out there for 15 or 20 minutes without being told to leave.
Yes. I don't know what happened there, but, you know, it's maybe the fact is that we had the right to stand there and to free speech, and we exercised it, that we were doing nothing wrong. You know, it's just that in many cases you're stopped even though you're doing nothing wrong. As in,
and told not to photograph.
When we were trying to protest the Bush Library.
What you did was added to the momentum to try to get her out of there. The federal law has a program called compassionate release. And when people are as sick as Lynn is, they're supposed to be allowed to go home. And she could also get better medical care here. You know, the medical care she's getting there, when they take her, she's in a prison hospital, when they move her to a place where she can get chemo, they put her in 10-pound chains. And then when they put her on a gurney, they lock her onto the gurney. She had a victory, though, and we were talking about that before the show started. Tell us about the victory.
Yes, the appeal first went to the warden of the facility where she is, and just the other day, the warden gave a ruling that she is eligible for compassionate release because of her condition and her failing condition of her health, and that it would be compassionate to release her to her family and friends and loved ones and to better medical conditions where she might be able to thrive.
So she's on first base, but as Heidi and I understand that, either the Department of Justice or the Bureau of Prisons has to make a motion to the sentencing judge, Kotal, and he has to so order her release, and we're not there yet.
Right.
But we'll put up the address of the head of the Bureau of Prisons on our website, lawanddisorder.org, as well as the address and how you can add your name to the petition.
Yes, this is urgent. Time is of the essence, and really, this is the petition to sign. If you don't usually sign petitions, please sign this one, and or you know, go online to lynnstewart.org. The petition is there. You could do it immediately.
And letters help too. Didn't I think the prison said that he'd received thousands of letters and just couldn't deal with it. So this works.
Yeah. Yes, letters as well. And now there's a new address to send the letters into the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And even I think some are asking for Barack Obama to receive letters.
Can't hurt.
Yeah.
That's lynnstewart.org to get those addresses.
Lori, what kind of media response did you encounter on your library protest?
Well, we arrived there early in the morning to get, you know, stake our ground, and the media was already there. Big cameras. There were serious photojournalists there, and also there was media. I was interviewed several times. We were photographed hundreds and hundreds of times because it's very, very dramatic. If you go on wewillnotbesilent.net, or our Facebook page, We Will Not Be Silent, you could see some of the images, and they've been shared through social media. So the next day, we check the papers and the news, and not a word or a photograph about us, or very, very little, if any. And there you have it. We witness the media. They witness us, but then it's edited out and it's not part of the picture. And we were part of the picture. And we should know that when that's happening, the people in power have consolidated power because they now control the media so that they can abuse power and have absolute power. And that's what torturing people is. That's what using drone warfare is. That's what's having a policy of assassination and killing unarmed civilians. That's what that is. That's absolute power. No due process. People in Guantanamo Bay being held after they have already been cleared for release. That's absolute power.
And now being force-fed with tubes.
And now being force-fed with tubes.
Because of the 100 of them that are, of the 160, 100 of them are on hunger strike. And because of that, Obama was asked a question last week at his press conference about it. And he said, this is making America look very bad. This is not what we stand for. We'd like to get him out of there. But he's waffling and he could do it with an executive order, get him out of there. Of the 160 people there, 100 have been cleared. They're guilty of nothing. They were picked up by mistake, and they won't let those people out. And there are others who should have been tried, and they won't try them because they've been tortured, and they can't use the evidence that they gained from torture in the trial. So they're stuck there too. It makes the image of the United States look very terrible. Obama knows that, and he admits that. But so far, they haven't done anything about it.
I think in the New York Times, he is quoted as asking the question, why are we doing this? Yeah. It just begs the question, why is he asking the question, and why isn't he doing anything about it?
Laurie, we're running out of time. Is there a website where listeners can go to find out more about what you and others are doing?
Yes. WeWillNotBeSilent.net. And our Facebook is We Will Not Be Silent. And please join us. We do conduct actions in New York closer to home than Texas. And we would love for people to come from your audience to join us or get more information.
Well, thank you for doing this for all these years. It's made a huge difference.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
I love Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Thanks, Laurie.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace. Yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. I've got to get it equal rights.
Palestine.